Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History, our regular bonus episode. Tom, our Paris episodes have just come out. We really enjoyed our trip to Paris, didn't we?
We really did, because you were always in such a grump about Paris, having had food poisoning there.
I did.
And then we went there in May, didn't we? And it couldn't have been more beautiful. It was a very Emily in Paris trip.
I haven't seen that, Tom.
Well, I haven't either, but you know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Gorgeous blue skies, Parisian ladies with little poodles. I mean, it was the whole vibe.
Bistros with kind of red checkerboard patterns on their tablecloths. And we were there with Theo, our producer, who's always a great company, who is actually French. So, or at least half French.
So he claims.
Went to school in France. So he speaks perfect French.
And does look like a dauphin in the Middle Ages, maybe the 15th century.
Do you think he does?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he looks like a minor Napoleonic general. Right. On that note, we did promise you, didn't we? By the way, Tom, just on the Paris, it's a good story, isn't that? Paris, 1968, the Gauls come back. An extraordinary thing to happen in such recent history that de Gaulle thought he was going to have to conceivably raise an army and march on Paris.
Lots of French intellectuals. You love a French intellectual, don't you?
Well, I mean...
You played it as a basically a comedy, which I knew you would.
I spent a lot of my early 20s reading French intellectuals.
So did I.
For my French literature part of my degree. And it left me with a very healthy skepticism, I think it's fair to say, about the intellectual merits.
I was all over Foucault and Derrida.
Were you?
And now I look back on it as a kind of youthful madness.
Yeah.
But I think a good inoculation.
Definitely. So we promised you all that we would try a little bit harder to get through all your questions, because we know that you spend a lot of time putting all those questions on the Discord.
And then we just witter. So we're going to cut back on the wittering.
So, exactly. So we've got a massive list, which Theo has heroically compiled. We're going to try and get through them, not just today, but in the bonus episodes over the next few weeks. So, Tom, do you want to kick off by picking a question?
Yeah, well, I'm going to pick one for you, which has been sent in by Jamie DJ.
Yeah.
And he asks, have you considered writing more on 20th century American history?
Okay, that's a good question. So for those people who are new to the Rest is History Club, my PhD was on American history. It was on the political career of Senator Eugene McCarthy, who challenged Lyndon Johnson in 1968 for the Democratic presidential nomination about the Vietnam War. And then there's a follow-up to that, which was about American politics in the sort of mid to late 70s, called Mad as Hell. And actually, my plan at the time was to continue writing more about American history, because I was an academic historian of America. But then I got sidetracked by writing books about Britain.
Because you had chucked in your academic career and set out to live by your pen on Grub Street.
Exactly, to live by my pen. And to be honest, as a commercial proposition, the British arm of my enterprise was doing, you know, I had to choose between the two. You can't really do both. And the British arm was, it was just doing better. So it was a no-brainer, really.
I would say globally, they'd be more interested in American than British history, modern British history.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Reagan has a greater resonance than Callahan.
Maybe, but I don't know. If you walked in, that's certainly true. But I think if you walked into a bookshop in Toulouse, how many books on American history would there be? There would be books on maybe Native Americans. There'd be a book on John F. Kennedy. And I would guess that would probably be it.
But I would say things on Vietnam, or because the kind of history you do is you're very interested in the kind of popular culture that people generally are interested in. So you are interested in the impact of Star Wars or Saturday Night Fever or whatever. I mean, I can absolutely imagine you writing on those themes in the way that you were writing about British sitcoms that perhaps have less international purchase.
Well, I think, first of all, the American historians who do that already, let's say Rick Perlstein, he writes about the 1960s, 1970s, and so on. I would be quite surprised if he was translated into a lot of European languages, because I think his work is so immersed in Americana that actually it would be meaningless to. So I suspect a lot of his sales abroad are in English and are among foreign readers who read English and read the American, order the American editions and read them. The second thing is American modern historiography is so crowded. It's much more crowded than British. So if you look at my field, Tom, the 60s, 70s, that I basically have one rival, David Kynaston, who is a lovely fellow. I know him well. We get on very well. There's space for his books and my books. But there's not a huge torrent of people trying to do the same thing. Whereas in the States, you know, biographies of Richard Nixon, let's say, are 10 a penny. So I think it's just much more crowded and much more difficult.
But it's tremendous news for the Rest is History. because you've done all this work, you have all this material, lots of which hasn't been published because you had to cut it all.
I know, crazy.
So it means that we can just recycle it.
So basically, if you're interested in American politics circa 1975, I have hundreds of thousands of words of material. So that's my answer on that. I would love to, well, would I love to go back to it? I mean, it would be, I'm sure it'd be great fun to go back to it. I just can't, looking at my diary for the next few years, thinking about my schedule, it's, I just can't conceive where I find the time, but who knows? Now, one for you, Tom, because I know you like a bit of science. I don't quite understand what this question means, but I'm going to ask it to you nonetheless. It's from Lambert Simnel Cake, 1477. Are popular history and true history, I don't know what the distinction is there, it's an interesting distinction, are they akin to Newtonian physics and quantum theory? One you learn at school but is not wholly accurate. The other, many are never taught but holds the truth. Answers on a Roman quark, please.
So the use of the word popular history not being true history, we might come on to that in a minute. I'm guessing that what that means is that you are taught, so in physics, the physics you're taught at school, you know, with all the laws, Boyle's law and that kind of thing. And then you go on to study physics at university and it's all mad stuff about cats being killed or not killed or whatever.
Yeah.
And essentially, you find that the Newtonian physics has its limits, that you've been taught the school-ready level of the subject, but that almost everything you get taught at school, if you go on to study it further, requires refinement. I think that probably is true, isn't it? I think that a lot of the history that you get taught at school, the point of it is to provide a kind of foundation for questioning the received accounts. I mean, not always, not necessarily. I don't think it's a precondition. But I think part of studying any subject in greater detail is to realize that things you're taught as a child are more complex than your teacher perhaps implied. I mean, that's inevitable.
I totally agree with you there, Tom. And isn't the parallel with physics an interesting one? Because actually the missing element often from a school history course is uncertainty.
Yes, so the uncertainty principle there.
The uncertainty principle. I mean, I think about this with the books I've written for children, for sort of 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, whatever, between 8 and 12. Uncertainty is actually a real foe there of a good narrative. And my son, who's my first reader, often comments on this. He just says, I want a really good story. I don't want you saying you don't know. Make it your mind. Now, sometimes you can have a mystery. You could do The Princes and the Tower as a mystery. But you can't just be havering and clearing your throat and, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, in a children's book.
So your account of Caesar's assassination, you're pooling multiple contradictory accounts.
Yes, exactly. To become a single account. Yes. The only thing I would say is that actually, I think popular history, school history, there's a slight sense in the question that they are lesser and that there's some kind of true, perfect history that is better. But actually, even when I think about the history I did at university, and indeed, the history I sometimes read in many books by, you know, scholars, I kind of think to myself, yeah, but it's a bit more complicated than that, isn't it? You can read books by very fine scholars where you'll come across a paragraph where you kind of think, it's much more complicated than that. You know, don't you think, Tom?
Well, you talked about writing for children, and I've touched on this before, so apologies for reheating it. But I found writing my book about ancient Greece, where I introduced the gods into the narrative of the Persian War, that in a way that enabled me to get around a problem that I think besets all academic history, which is how you integrate a materialist objective perspective with the need to evoke a world in which people believe things that you don't believe.
Yeah.
I think that's a consistent nagging problem that has... I wrestle with more and more the more I write.
I always remember my first year at university studying with the late Mark Witto, a great historian of the Byzantine Empire. And we did in the course of one of the tutorials, we were talking about one of the sieges of Constantinople and the bit where they bring out, you know, an icon of the Virgin Mary. And it sort of, as we were talking about it, he was talking about it like this had really happened. And the icon had genuinely scared away, you know, the Rus or the Arabs or whoever it was. And I said, but how, I mean, you can't really think that happened. And he said, well, how do you know it didn't happen? I mean, the sources tell you it happened. You know, I mean, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with you can't just say these things clearly didn't have that power, so this is all nonsense. You know, you have to wrestle with the complexities, don't you?
So I think that you could, I mean, you could almost say that, I mean, when I was a child and I read about the legendary histories of Greece or Rome, I wanted to believe that they were true. They worked on me viscerally on that level.
Yeah.
And then I kind of grew up and put aside childish things and approached it with a materialist sense, a sense that the inadequacy of the sources, weighing it all up, all that kind of thing. But now I increasingly think that there is a need to get back to that kind of childlike perspective, the perspective of someone who is seduced by the wonder of it all, because in a sense, that is closer to how people saw it in the ancient past.
Yeah.
And it may be that it's a need to kind of fuse both those perspectives. And I think how you do that is an incredible challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the less so when writing about income tax policy in the early 70s or something, I guess.
Well, I mean, to go back to Lambert Simnelcake's question, I do think the idea of a true history and something holding the truth, some listeners will say, oh, this is very postmodernist of him or whatever. I just don't believe there is such a thing. I just believe I genuinely believe there are an infinite number of competing accounts, some of which we can say, based on our knowledge of the sources, are more faithful to the sources than others. And we can reject some that are very unfaithful. So, for example, we could reject Holocaust denial. You wouldn't completely open the door to everything. But I think the idea there's ever a single true account is obviously not right. Don't you, Tom?
I do. And we were talking about Derrida and French literary theory.
Yeah.
They famously argue that everything is text, that signifier and signified, that the relationship is not absolute, and that what we talk about truth has to be mediated by language and by extension by literature, so that sources are literary as well as approximations to objective truth. And I do kind of hold to that. And I think it's particularly true, perhaps, of sources for ancient and medieval literature. So if you call Tacitus a primary source, it's not really a primary source in the way that you would call a primary source, say, for the 1970s primary.
Yeah.
It's a very, very literary text. And I think there is a sense in which writing a lot of ancient history is literary criticism.
I agree with you completely, Tom. So think about when I did the Adventures in Time about Alexander the Great, so conscious that all the sources, so many of them are written hundreds and hundreds of years later, and they are literary constructs.
Constructs, absolutely.
They use formulae. And actually, my own version is just basically taking, like all accounts of Alexander actually, is taking literary formulae and playing with them and choosing your favorite, in a way. This seems most plausible to me. This makes most sense based on my preconceptions about Alexander's psychology and his character. What's he most likely to have done?
Yeah, you're doing that for children. I mean, I would say that when I write ancient history for an adult audience, I'm consciously trying to shape the literary material in a way that is true to that literary inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I'm just thinking, oh, well, I'll take that bit, or I'll take that bit, or I'll take that bit. I'm trying to construct a narrative that is a commentary on the literary sources that we have.
Can I ask you a question though, Tom? When you're doing that, so let's say you're writing about Nero or whatever it is, there would be two different imperatives, presumably. One would be you want to tell the reader what your best guess as to what happened and why.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you also want to construct a literary narrative yourself, in which you want, and certainly your publishers and publicists will want, the maximum possible narrative color, sex and violence, and so on. So are those two things sometimes in contradiction?
No, I don't think so. I would say that I have two objectives. The first is to, insofar as one can, construct a sense of what happened when, you know, at the most basic level, a sense of the chronology, a sense of the dates, a sense of the various people, the prosopography of it, namely what the relationship of all these different people are, situating them in the broader context of the Roman world, marshalling source evidence from archaeology as well as from literary texts. But at the same time, recognizing that the idea that you can arrive at the truth is a fantasy. You can't. We can never know exactly what happened because we are looking through a glass darkly. And so therefore, the fact that it is mediated in a literary way has to be integrated into the fabric of what you are writing. And you can do that because the literary traditions are expressive of political traditions. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the source material for Nero's reign is expressive of a distinctive political outlook, and you can integrate that, but you can work out from it, I think, when you integrate it, say, with evidence from Nero's coinage or whatever, what Nero himself is thinking. And Nero is a really good example because it's evident that he is making play with his reputation in a very, very literary manner. You know, his taking to the stage, his playing roles on the stage, he knows exactly what he's doing. And you can therefore frame the narrative in terms of, I think, legitimately, how Nero sees what he's doing and how later historians like Tacitus are framing it in a way that you are being true to the source material while also presenting the different perspectives that are embodied in the source material as perspectives that are negative towards Nero and expressive of Nero himself. That would be my argument.
But I noticed you haven't answered one part of the question.
What was the question?
Surely for writing for a large mass audience, which you hope to do, you would want to put the accent on the most, I mean, you're never going to completely downplay the most sensational elements of the story. Surely what you would do, I'm guessing, is you would have your cake and eat it.
No, I am kind of answering it, I think, because Nero is a master of sensationalism.
Okay.
He is doing things that are shocking, are scandalous, are dramatic, are calculated to enthuse vast numbers of people, even as they simultaneously appall other numbers of people. So the spectacular actions with which Nero is associated, mm-hmm. I think you can assume that the challenge is to make sense of what is going on. You could, at one extreme, say, this is all just made up by Nero's critics. It never happened. But I think that that's a very inadequate way of approaching the source material.
That's fine. But if you were to take a less obviously sensational character, you're never going to downplay the sex and violence, are you?
Right. So if Nero kills his mother, I mean, that yeah. seems to me clear. It's clear he does. And we know that because Nero himself makes play with it.
Yeah.
So what is going on with that? There are things that Nero casts himself as a tragic hero. Tragic heroes, mythic heroes in the ancient world kill their mothers. And by virtue of that, are elevated above the common rank. A normal person, if he kills his mother, that's a terrible crime, the worst crime mm-hmm. that you can commit. If, you know, the son of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra does it, then that marks him out as a hero of myth, a hero of tragedy, someone whose name will reverberate down the generations. Nero is casting himself as that. And that, I think, is why he's taking up tragic roles. So you can see that that is where he is coming from, even as you can also see that from the perspective of a writer like Tacitus, it's a monstrous crime and deserves to be condemned, pure and simple, as a monstrous crime. So you can frame both the perspectives on it while also acknowledging that he kills his mother. And an emperor killing his mother is, of course, inherently dramatic.
That's a very long and complicated way of answering a question about whether you put sex and violence in your books. And
I do. Well, Dominic, you know I put sex and violence in my books.
Let's have the next question.
Okay. Sarah C. We'll ask her, she's asking her, what is her usual question? When can we have episodes on post-1945 Italy?
This would be a very good subject. I think we would do, so if I was doing this and I was choosing...
Could we do prime ministers?
I wouldn't do prime ministers because there are so many. What I would do is the years of lead, as they're called. So I would do 70s Italy, because I think that's the most interesting. It's when you've got the conspiracy theories, you have domestic terrorism, a bomb in Bologna Station. Was it done by the Italian right in collaboration with the security services? You could do it around the personality of Andreotti. So there's a really good, is it a film? I think it's a film.
Yeah, it is.
About Andreotti.
In which he looks like Nosferatu. They make great play with it, that he's a vampire. Kind of bald, big ears.
I think the way to do Italy would be, so that's one way to do it, would be to really go into the all the conspiracy theories and the terrorism of the 70s. The other way that I used to have a massive fondness, I just sort of have drifted out of it, I don't know why, for Italian films of the 1940s, 1950s, so the kind of near-realist films. Bicycle Thieves, I guess, is the most famous. And then Fellini and Visconti and Bernardo Bertolucci's film, The Conformist, which is a brilliant film about fascism.
I worry that films don't work, Dominic.
I know, but we did a series about French films with Muriel Zaga. We did an episode about French films. That was very jolly.
We did, but it was framed as a discussion of French history rather than film. I think lots of people won't have seen these films, and it's difficult to talk about films that you haven't seen.
Well, I'll maybe trade it with you for one of your saints or something like that.
Yeah, but saints are history, Dominic.
But incredibly boring.
You want to do a film show? So I would no, but you said sex. I would say do Berlusconi. He's a tremendous character.
Oh, I've got no interest in doing Berlusconi.
Why? It's got football. It's got sex.
I find him boring.
Bunga bunga parties.
It's current affairs. It's boring current affairs. It's like reading an article in The Economist. Let's do that. Anyway, Sarah, honestly. Yeah, we will do it. But clearly there are big disputes to be had back off air about what we'll do. Nick Rogers, Tom, are there any previous episodes that you would revisit in light of what you've learned from researching and recording more recent episodes?
It's funny. If I think about the early ones, French Revolution is the notorious example where we did it in 50 minutes, or The Wild West. They seem to me like, and I'm not in any way comparing us to the Beatles, but they are the love me do of our oeuvre.
Right.
And we've now reached the kind of more Rococo Sergeant Pepper stage.
Have we? Oh, wow.
Tracks go on for, you know, 30 minutes or something and are full of farmyard noises and strange sitars and things.
Right.
We are doing things in greater depth, I think, because when we began, we were knocking out episodes on the assumption that we wouldn't be doing it for very long.
Yeah.
You know, French Revolution, Wild West, King Arthur. We were basically going for the greatest hits, weren't we? Banging them out.
And also we were taking a lot of episode suggestions from Tony, our executive producer, who really his interest is slightly more in politics, I think, than in history. Because if you remember when we first came up with subjects, so those first episodes, is Trump more like Caesar or Nixon, is a very Tony subject, isn't it? It's basically a current affairs with a leavened with a bit of history.
But it also, that was an attempt to bundle in both our fields of expertise.
Yes, it was. It was. But we did, so a lot of those early episodes are actually, we just didn't know what the podcast was going to be. We had no sense of the format.
We weren't putting in the degree of research that we would now put in. There was we were basically drawing on the often faintly inchoate level of our general knowledge on a subject, which was perhaps enough for us to get by, but probably not enough to sustain.
Because I think when we started, there was no sense that we would be doing, that it would take up multiple days, was there? It was sort of, we'll convene every week, Tuesday at 4:30.
We'll have a chat
for 45 minutes and then we'll put that out and probably nobody will ever listen. So I don't think, if you listen to those first episodes and you think, oh, they didn't, you know, well, we probably didn't do any thinking before we started recording the episode 4 or whatever it might be. So obviously not the case now, is it, Tom, where we've just, I am surrounded by like pieces of paper and Word documents and sort of books about really Rococo.
Heavy tomes.
Yeah, recondite bits of history. We can do one more question. We don't want to go on too long because Theo, our producer, who is massively under the cosh this week, he has to record this one, to edit this one so that you can actually hear it. So we've only got time for one more question. And this is from Claire H. So she has been listening to the American Revolution episodes. She's a massive fan of Adam Smith, quite rightly in my view. That the American Revolution is a huge part of American national mythology, but the great man theory of history has been challenged before by Charles Beard without shaking its foundations. Is the current critique of the Founding Fathers different in tone or effect from Charles Beard's critique of 100 years ago? Tom, do you know what she's talking about with Charles Beard? Because I know you're not an expert on American history.
No.
So Charles Beard was a kind of progressive era historian whose approach to history was, I suppose you would say, it was kind of more Marxist. It was more socialist. So he argued, he wrote about the economic motives of the people behind the American Revolution. He said, you know, we think of these as these tremendous kind of, you know, freedom fighters, blah, 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 blah. But actually they are rich people. They're defending their class interests. There's all kind of class interests and economic interests.
Is he zoning in on slavery?
Slavery as property ownership, but not slavery
but not as a moral crime.
Not well. I mean, I can't exactly remember Charles Beard. I'm sure as a progressive historian, he wouldn't be in favor of slavery. It'd probably be quite the reverse. But I don't think the issue had the same charge that it would have today. And I think that, to me,
is the big difference, I think.
Yeah. I think that whole issue about the American Revolution and slavery is a fascinating one because obviously what it ultimately tells you about is the moral preoccupations of 2023, don't you think, Tom?
I do.
The whole business about the 1619 project. You know, you and I were talking just before we started recording about the American Revolution episodes and about the, I thought there would be more commentary, there would be more reaction about our discussion about the 1619 project than there would be about your impersonation of John Adams. But I was quite wrong. but on the whole 1619 project thing, what do you, well, as an outsider to the subject, what do you make of all that sort of stuff deep down? Do you think it's all nonsense, or do you think it's a salutary corrective, or what?
I think it's a bit like when people fake Renaissance paintings, and for 20 years it looks like a Renaissance painting, and then suddenly it looks like it was painted in the 1930s, because you can tell.
Yeah.
So I think that there are lots of, because the American Revolution, the Founding Fathers, stand so much at the heart of how America presents itself. Therefore, the history around it is peculiarly political. And so to take a position on the American Revolution is basically to take a position on America today.
Yeah.
And so therefore, it's always been an object and a subject for political as well as historical polemics. And so therefore, I think that by and large, you can tell when particularly polemical perspectives on the American Revolution were written by the context of the society that gave it birth. So yeah. I would say that in 50 years' time, the 1619 Project will be studied by historians of the early 21st century, not of the late 18th century.
Yeah, of course it will.
I would be my guess. I mean, I may be wrong. I don't know. But so like your Marxist, Charles Beard,
yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing that his book tells you more about the impact of Marxism in America in the early 20th century than it does about the Founding Fathers.
Yes, you could absolutely right. I'm not actually certain that he's a Marxist, but I'm just reading about him now, reminding myself.
His dates.
So he lived between 1874 and 1948. His most influential book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. But here's a fascinating thing. So by the 1960s, Tom, he had been completely rejected.
Right.
So Richard Hofstadter, another very great American historian, wrote in 1968, "Today, Charles Beard's reputation stands like an imposing ruin in the landscape of American historiography. What was once the grandest house in the province is now a ravaged survival." And that's sort of true. Right. I mean, that's basically, that's a brilliant lesson for any historian. Your work will, decades hence, be regarded as a ludicrously dated, incorrect, wrong,
or
relic
of
your
age,
regarded
as a fascinating illustration of perspectives in the period that you're writing.
Of course, it'll be regarded as both, hopefully, right? I mean, people might say, I mean, the best you can hope for as a historian is that decades hence, people will say, completely wrong, of course, but a wonderful read. I mean, like people say about Sir Stephen Runciman's books on the Crusades or Gibbon on the Roman Empire or any of that. You know, people read those for pleasure. I would read those for pleasure.
But Gibbon tells you a lot about the Enlightenment.
Of course he does.
I mean, you know, and that I guess will be true of the 1619 Project.
Yeah. Now, Theo, I know you want us to stop. Just to tell you what you have to look forward to. You have Vesuvius.
The eruption thereof.
You have Catherine of Siena. There is Tom's favourite episode, Love Island 2. And maybe, just maybe, Tom, the long dreamed of, much debated appearance of Viking sorcery. So that will be coming soon.
But I'm worried, Dominic, that if we put it out, the ravens of Odin will descend and peck us to death.
Well, it's been discussed so long that, I mean, even though it's a very good episode, people are saying, oh, after all the build-up. Yeah. Right, and on that bombshell, goodbye.
Bye-bye.